This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Beat me up on the mamas of all mama shit.
Hey, I'm looking through my telescope and I see a mothership. Is that you? Beam me up.
Hey, DA, I'm thirsty, man. Can you beam me up for a cold one?
Hey, DA, what's going on, baby? Stop me off and beam me up.
DA, what's the dealio? Permission to get in that mothership.
Is my window seat still available? Beam me up.
What's going on, DA? Hey, man, I need you to do me a huge favor. My coworker's a jerk. Oh, just beam me up, man.
Get beamed up. Everyone else has. It's DA on CBS Sports Radio.
And we come to you live from the Quicken Loan Studios. National mortgage lender Quicken Loans. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently. Coming up this hour on the show, friend of the DA, Taylor Twellman, ESPN soccer analyst, MLS Cup coming up, Portland Timbers, Atlanta United. How about Atlanta United putting 70,000 people in Mercedes-Benz Stadium for a playoff game? People might not realize, if you're not connected to the soccer world, just how crazy the support is for Atlanta United. This is a quote-unquote fair weather sports town, and they're putting 70,000 people. They're banging out. They're filling up. They're selling out the home of the Falcons for MLS games. Regular season as well, but now in the playoffs, and they'll host MLS Cup against the Portland Timbers. So he'll join us coming up here in about 15 minutes from now. So it's a Trash Tuesday. Get your trashes in. We'll take the trashes. We'll read the trashes. And you'll get a full-on Trash Tuesday experience. And if I had another trash, although that is not fair, that is not part of the rules or regulations here on the DA show, if I had multiple trashes, I think I would trash John Gruden as well. Because I just feel as though John Gruden is not only making it up as he goes along, but now he's openly lying about what he knows and what he does not. It's one thing to rip apart the roster because you don't see a champion there, you don't see a contender. It's one thing to say we don't have the money to have Khalil Mack under contract and Derek Carr under the contract. We can't afford everybody. It's one thing to trade away Amari Cooper. It's one thing to bring in veterans as stopgaps right now, knowing that you're probably going to be a loser. But that's all roster building and coaching. This is about game management and understanding the rules of the game. In Sunday's loss to the Chiefs, just before halftime, Travis Kelce had a touchdown catch just before the half and just before the Chiefs kicked the extra point. John Gruden challenged the play. Kelce appeared to trap the ball on the ground. It's called a touchdown for the Chiefs. John Gruden challenges the play. There's only one small problem, and that is it's a touchdown or a scoring play, and all scoring plays are reviewed. And it's within the final 2 minutes of the half, so again, all plays are automatically reviewed. So John Gruden throwing a challenge flag with just seconds to play before the half, on a would-be touchdown, made two mistakes. You can't challenge a score, and you can't challenge final 2 minutes of a half. He was assessed a timeout. John Gruden was not asked about this faux pas during his press conference yesterday. But at the very tail end of his presser, he was asked about the status of Martavis Bryant. And in doing so, launched into a defense of why he challenged that play.
I have no sense. Common sense or sense on Brian? I lack sense. I threw a challenge flag with 7 seconds, I think, left yesterday. I knew exactly what I was doing, by the way. It wasn't a very sensible thing to do, but I wanted to challenge Al Riveron in New York City to look at it because I have people in the press box telling me that's not a catch. And, you know, I just seeing plays overturned by somebody you can't even see, I thought with 3 timeouts and 7 seconds left, I'd use one of my timeouts by giving Al a little extra time to look at that play. But I knew exactly what I was doing.
This is ugly. What can I say? This is really ugly. John Gruden is lying. John Gruden did not know the rule there. John Gruden has now coached in 12 games, 13 games, whatever it is, and forgot that all scoring plays are reviewed. Because what? He was sending a message to a guy in New York City? What's the message? Uh-oh. I better make sure I review this because John Gruden's on the sidelines. This is the cat and mouse game that John Gruden is playing with the guy in New York City reviewing touchdowns? I don't think so. And even if I'm supposed to take him at face value, even if I'm supposed to believe that John Gruden purposefully, mistakenly challenged a scoring play knowing he couldn't, knowing it burns a timeout, even if I'm believing that, Gruden was not asked about it. Gruden was asked about Martavis Bryant. So Gruden was armed with that defense going into that press conference. He was prepared to defend it because he knew it looked stupid and people were criticizing it. I've got a little bit of a problem with the Oakland media giggling and laughing for a team that's 2-10 and has sold off two of its best parts, Khalil Mack and Amari Cooper. I've got a little bit of a problem with everybody seeming so hunky-dory with a goofy press conference at 2-10 and a franchise that is 1 foot out the door going to Las Vegas so that one of the best cities in America when it comes to football is going to lose its birthright franchise. But John Gruden is going into press conferences ready to defend his mistakes. What does that tell you? He is consumed about perception. He's consumed about how he looks, which is why he tells Howie Long, Howie, I got guys calling me in the middle of the night saying, I want to play for the Raiders. That's why he does this. That's why he's doing this. That's why this is a mistake. He's consumed by the perception of John Gruden coaching. And when John Gruden is consumed by John Gruden, it's a bad day. When we come back, ESPN soccer analyst Taylor Twellman's going to join us. DA, CBS Sports Radio.
Good value, big upside.
Morning, DA. How you doing? So I caught up on your Nomad show, and I really think it's excellent that you do that when you go to places. Me, as a fan of your show, I now feel a little bit closer to you as a sportscaster, even as just an individual.
It's DA on CBS Sports Radio.
And check out my newest episode of Nomad, my digital travel series on YouTube, as I travel to Athens, Georgia, to take on an SEC game between the hedges. It was Auburn, it was Georgia, and we saw what the Bulldogs did to Alabama on Saturday. What a thrill it was to finally get to Athens, Georgia for a college football game, but that included some amazing ribs. Check it out on YouTube, my digital travel series, Nomad. The Player of the Week brought to you by Grainger. Taking a look at the one who got it done, Todd Gurley. The Rams running back powers the Rams attack over the Lions. 23 rushes, 132 yards, and 2 touchdowns. This guy has been huge for them, also choosing not to run into the end zone, draining more time off the clock instead of taking it into the end zone. Gurley finishes the drive with a 2-run score, and the Rams clinch the NFC West title for the second straight season. The Player of the Week brought to you by Grainger. Grainger's got your back when it comes to the safety and industrial supplies that keep your facility running. Get what you need when you need it, Grainger.com. MLS Cup is here, the one-game championship for MLS. The Portland Timbers taking on Atlanta United FC. And our next guest is an MLS icon, a former member of the U.S. men's national team as well, and a soccer analyst for ESPN. It is our great pleasure to open up the Johnny Carson curtains here and welcome on my good friend, Taylor Twellman. Taylor, good morning.
DA, what's going on, my friend? Long time.
I know, man. How's it going?
I know. It's been a long time, dude. How are you?
I'm great. How are you doing? We always will chat over text message or social media or whatnot, but I haven't actually had a chance to catch up with you in person. Everything good with you? Season's been good?
Yeah, you know, MLS season, the soccer season's a long season, my friend. Like, you know this, covering all the sports. Football is like a sprint compared to what we do, and even the 82-game NHL NBA season, just it's a long season, but it's coming to an end here in Major League Soccer, and also with some excitement on some levels that U.S. Soccer's hired a new coach. It's ever-ending. It's 365 days a year, my friend.
Let me ask you about Greg Berhalter getting the call. This took over a year for U.S. men's national team to decide who was going to be the head coach. There's a lot of pressure and scrutiny on this. You have been very openly critical of the duration of the time of this search. At the end of the day, do you think they got it right?
I do, by the criteria that they've laid out, right? So U.S. Soccer coming out and saying they wanted, you know, and in the press conference today is going to have a huge, I think, explanation to the, you know, how the process went about. Yes, I do. I think Greg Berhalter's young. He's energetic. He's very meticulous. He's very detail-oriented. He's done a phenomenal job with a less expensive, for lack of a better phrase, roster in Columbus and gotten them to play at a high level so he can execute a game plan. But, D.A., the reality is this, is that he's still in the coaching world. He's young. He's inexperienced. First time with the international way. And for the listeners at home, you work when you're a club coach, you work with them all day, same players. All day, every day, back to back. At most, in one calendar year, Greg Berhalter will be in camp on a field with his players 80 days at most. So he's got to be very good at being able to bring a group together in 3 days and getting them ready to play a game, and I think ultimately that's why he got the job. But when you have the optics of it, D.A., of Lopetegui, who went undefeated with Spain, Tata Martino, who was interested in the job, Juan Carlos Osorio, who was spoken to, and that will be a little bit, that's a little breaking news on your radio show. That will be announced today that they did speak to Mexico head coach Juan Carlos Osorio. The point is that the optics of this all puts needless amount of pressure on Greg Berhalter, and they didn't need to. Greg could have been hired 8 months ago, used the last 7-8 friendlies, gotten his feet wet, got a good understanding of the group, but instead they went about it this way. The only thing that matters now is results, and Greg's got a little bit more pressure on him than previous years because he needs to get him immediately.
So you were one of the strongest voices critical of the fact that U.S. did not qualify for the World Cup, and you were all over ESPN, and I think your voice was maybe loudest in this. When you look at where the U.S. men's national team is, do you feel like with this hire that men's national team fans, American soccer fans, should feel like, okay, this is the right step in the right direction? Or are you still skeptical that they can get to where they need to get?
Skeptical. And it has nothing to do with Greg Berhalter. I'm skeptical. You know, we interviewed Michael Parkhurst, a former national team player and captain of Atlanta United right now, and he said, I said, and he played for Greg Berhalter, and I said, what's your biggest concern about Greg Berhalter? And he said, well, Greg's got to get the guys believing in playing for the red, white, and blue again. Like, D.A., when you hear that soundbite, you're like, wait, what? What does that mean? So it actually has nothing to do with Greg Berhalter. My skepticism still relies on how many Americans are playing at a high level around the world? How many Americans are playing consistently in Major League Soccer? You could have the best coach in the world, but if you don't have the players, that's not good enough either. So my skepticism still remains. And I've actually said this over the last 48 hours. I've texted with Greg Berhalter. He is a former teammate of mine, and we've had some good conversations, but that's why he was hired. So if he comes out and they win a ton of games and the young Americans are playing, well, D.A., my skepticism turns very quickly. But if you call me a year from now and we're still talking about whether or not anyone else is playing in Europe other than Christian Pulisic and Weston McKennie, well, then all of a sudden I'm sitting there saying, I don't care who your coach is, where are the players coming from? So I think the American fan will see it from results and less so just from saying, hey, we just hired Greg Berhalter.
ESPN soccer analyst Taylor Twellman, former U.S. men's national team member as well, joining us here on the DA show on CBS Sports Radio. You've also discussed openly concussion research intelligence protocol, and you're very vocal about this on social media. You've dealt with that in your past as well athletically. Where do you feel we are at with concussions and society at large, football, soccer, and other athletics?
We have the resources and tools that you and I, growing up, we never had. So the resources and tools is exponentially better, more detailed. And yet, you can still have the same resources and tools, but what do you do with the resources and tools? And for the listeners at home, let me ask you this. How many players in the NFL go through concussion rehab or the concussion protocol? And what's the percentage of them that are automatically back within 6 days for the next game?
Pretty quick.
And yet, scientists, doctors will tell us, oof, the percentage of that should be a lot lower than it is if we're properly rehabbing it. So, listen, protocols are fine. I do think right now, DA, too many leagues in our country are hiding behind a protocol. Protocols, now, it doesn't mean anything if you don't do it right. So I still think we're not completely looking at it the right way, and now you're starting to see the NHL have some real, you know, optical issues because people are really calling it out. Former players are saying there is none, and so it is what it is. The World Cup in 2014 in the final, Christoph Kramer got knocked out. FIFA didn't even look at it. FIFA's been sitting on their hands on a lot of issues, and until FIFA addresses it, our sport, soccer, football around the world, is going to still hide behind a protocol. And the reality is, I think U.S. soccer and Major League Soccer could lead that charge, and they may. But the fact that we have all these resources and tools and we're still making bad decisions, I'd argue it's worse.
Mm. Taylor Twellman joins us this morning on the show. MLS Cup is coming up on Saturday. Atlanta United, you called the first leg of the Red Bulls against Atlanta United in that last championship round. And you were at Mercedes-Benz Stadium. This game will be there as well. I mean, just how crazy is it? How awesome is it? There are 70,000 people that show up weekly to go watch Atlanta United, a soccer team, in the ATL, and they'll do it again on Saturday.
DA, I show up every time in Atlanta, Uber or cab driver, and they're arguing with me about something I said. And then the best part about this, DA, is then I'll argue with them about something about SEC football, and they blow me off. They're like, I don't want to talk about that. I don't care about that. Or the Falcons. Or anything. And Arthur Blank, to this day, and this isn't, he did his only in-game interview for the MLS All-Star game that he's ever done. Never done Falcons, anything. And I put him on the spot, and good on him for answering. I said, what's a better experience? And right now, what would you redo? And he goes, oh, Atlanta United blows the Falcons out of the water.
Wow.
From the entire weekend, from everything. He said, it is shocking to me that he didn't know this 20 years ago. And I said, I think you're being unfair, but the reality is, look at the Falcons-Ravens game from the past weekend. DA, you and I could have showed up, paid $10, and got in.
Yep.
Like, it just, the entire city, Alabama, Georgia, SEC championship game, in leading news stations is Atlanta United hosting MLS Cup. I'll leave it at that. And it's not, the best part about it for me, DA, is it's not me having to make it up. It's just fact. There's no opinion there. But I love landing and the Uber driver looking at me, calling me a complete idiot because I said the right back of Atlanta United's first touch isn't good enough. That's when you know you've made it.
That is awesome. For all of us MLS supporters, that is so cool. What a great sea change. And you are teaming up with Allstate Insurance. And the Allstate All-America Cup coming up at the MLS All-Star Game in Orlando, another wonderful MLS city coming up next summer. And you're going to be working with other U.S. men's national team members, U.S. women's national team members as well, looking at the elite high school soccer players. Talk to us about this project.
It's awesome, DA. You know, with the Christian Pulisics and the Weston McKennies of the world, you can see that soccer is just getting, players are getting better a lot earlier in their career. So Today we announced the first 150 high school junior soccer players that will be named All-State All-Americans. We'll name another 100 players later this spring. The 80 of those players will come to the All-State All-America Cup during MLS All-Star Week in Orlando. I'll be one of those coaches. But for me, it's about motivating younger players, D.A. You and I both know, if you're playing a sport and you're a freshman and now you hear about this All-State All-Americans are now in juniors, and these are the game changers in the sport. So it just was a natural fit for me to be involved, and anytime I can coach these kids or be around them, I love staying younger, so to speak, so I'm really looking forward to it.
Taylor Twellman, ESPN soccer analyst and truly an American icon and specifically a fashion icon, joining us here on the show. TT, it is great to finally catch up again. I'm sure we'll do it again soon.
D.A., great hearing your voice, my man.
You
too,
buddy.
Proud of you.
Back at you, my man. Back at you. Taylor Twellman joining us this morning here on the show. Good stuff. I mean, that is just, if you're a soccer fan in America, that is just the coolest thing that in Atlanta, the lead story is Atlanta United in the MLS Cup. It's great. What a great story that is. Just a great American sports story in general. And I liked his commentary on concussions and concussion protocol. I think leagues are, as he said, hiding behind protocol. Hiding behind, well, this is how it goes, and the doctors cleared him, so, hey, who am I to say? Who am I to judge? And there feels like there's still a long way to go to really, truly get where we need to get in terms of understanding about concussions, the after effects of concussions, long-term ramifications, and much, much more. Today, big news of the day is Urban Meyer. Urban Meyer decides to retire from Ohio State. Who knows if he ends up coaching again? His legacy is complicated, let's face it. Urban Meyer is one of the best coaches in college football history. That is not hyperbole. Whether it is Bear Bryant, Nick Saban, Urban Meyer is in the conversation as one of the greats of all time. He is. Bo Schembechler, Woody Hayes, go down the list. These are some of the legends, and Urban Meyer's in there. Three national championships, two different programs. He did it everywhere that he went. He won and won big. From a coaching perspective, from a recruiting perspective, he's awesome. I mean, he's just elite, historically awesome. But there will never be an ability to me, disassociate the off-the-field stuff and the scandals and the headaches and the saga. And I had headaches, pardon the pun, but I'm talking about the frustrations and the stress level and the bad news that has surrounded his programs at Florida and at Ohio State combined with the actual winning on the field. And I don't think you can disassociate the two. I think that is one that goes hand in hand. Urban Meyer, great head coach, completely questionable ethics. And I thought through the Zach Smith thing, he came off awful. He came off defiant, defensive, combative. When, I'm sorry, if you are housing a guy who committed domestic violence, the first thing you need to be is apologetic, remorseful, regretful, and compassionate to the victim. But he was none of those things. I think Urban Meyer has built up a screw you aura, and that helps him in coaching. Combative, argumentative, aggressive, defiant, stubborn. These are all actually good qualities when it comes to believing your team is going to win. But I think it's terrible in being a quote-unquote good person. And this is a guy that said, I'm going to walk away from Florida, walk away from coaching because I need to spend time with my family. And then that year away from his family, he was a broadcaster. I mean, you're going to spend time with the family, spend time with the family. But it wasn't quite about that. It was also about setting up his next job, which he took the following year at Ohio State. He's not a trustworthy dude, that's for sure, but he's a great head coach. 855-212-4CBS. It's a Trash Tuesday, 855-212-4227. When we come back here on the show, from the Wall Street Journal, editor and sports columnist Jonathan Clegg is going to join us. Let's talk about the business model of the college football playoff and if it can expand because of business as well as the league the NFL is trying to emulate. DA, CBS Sports Radio.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
We are the glitch in the simulation.
Eagle fans, we can hear you.
DA on CBS Sports Radio.
39 minutes past the hour. DA with you here on CBS Sports Radio. We appreciate you being with us on a fine Tuesday. Get your trashes in. Tweet at me, DA on CBS. Also, you can hit me up on Facebook, facebook.com/TheDAShow. CBS's Super Bowl season continues Sunday with exciting regional action. Playoff and wild card position up for grabs in critical AFC matchups when Baltimore battles Patrick Mahomes of the Chiefs. Andrew Luck leads Indy into Houston to take on the Texans, or the Phillip Rivers-led Chargers host the Bengals. Check your local listings and kick off your day with the NFL Today only on CBS. Chargers have become a very interesting storyline, to say the very least. Chargers trying to chase down the Kansas City Chiefs in the AFC West. And what would happen if they did and won the division and there's a home playoff game at the Home Depot Center, an MLS soccer stadium, and a home NFL playoff game? Yeah. It's at least in the cards. What about NFL expansion as well across the pond? And what about the one league the NFL looks at and says, we want to be them? Joining us here on the show is a man who has written a book, co-authored the book, The Club, How the English Premier League Became the Wildest, Richest, Most Disruptive Force in Sports. He has written for the Wall Street Journal as well and covered sports for WSJ. Jonathan Clegg joins us this morning on the show. Jonathan, good morning.
Good morning. How you doing?
I'm doing great. How you doing?
Good.
So, as somebody who grew up in England and you have seen the NFL try to push NFL football there for more than a decade, we always talk here on this side of the pond about if a full-time NFL team could work out there. I wonder every single day if it would work. In your estimation, do you think that is a possible thing that could happen years down the line?
I mean, I think the success they've had in the last sort of 10 years when they really made that sort of renewed commitment to try and push the NFL in London, I think you'd have to look at the results of that experiment and say, yeah, I think it probably can work. There will be obviously logistical hurdles to overcome, but you're talking about four games a season being played in London now. That's half a home schedule for an NFL fan base. You get 16 games a season, 8 at home. So if they're selling out four games a season, that's half a home slate. You have to think that an additional four games, you'd have to say they'd probably sell those games out too. And in that case, that starts to look like a viable franchise. How it would work, I've always thought, and I spent a couple of years covering the New York Giants for the Wall Street Journal, including when they played over in London. And I've always thought that the answer would be to have the team sort of play its home games in London, but be based for the off season in, Florida or somewhere on the East Coast. So the team would sort of operate in London during the NFL season, but all kind of other off-season activities, possibly including training camp, would probably be done here in the U.S., which would clear up a lot of the sort of problems about tax loopholes and that sort of thing that would arise if they based the team in London full-time.
On your point about that slate, you're right. Four games in London is half of a home slate, and if they could sell out four, who's to say they can't sell out eight? My question is, in terms of an appetite from the English fans, selling out four games that have interesting, different matchups, isn't that a little different than trying to sell out eight, let's say, Jaguars games, that you're getting a Jaguars-Colts game, a Jaguars-Texans game, a Jaguars-Titans game? Would it still have that appetite, do you feel, if it's one team?
I think that's a great question. I think, in all honesty, if you look at some of the matchups that they have sent over there, they have not been the best and the brightest of the NFL. I can think of some real duds that they've sent over there, a Dolphins-Giants game that was sort of finished 9-7 or something like that. So, English fans a hardy bunch. They've turned out for some pretty low key matchups in the past. You know, whether that would, you know, how they would sort of survive if, you know, there was a real, if the team was, you know, in the basement and really struggling week to week, how much enthusiasm there would be for that over the course of sort of 2, 3, 4 years if the team struggled early on. I think that's, you know, a question that they have to consider. But I think the fans, you know, the turnout at Wembley Stadium for these games has been pretty resilient. You know, the one thing I guess that you'd have to question is a lot of the fans that go to those games go as NFL fans. They, you see jerseys from all 32 teams represented in the stands, and those fans are sort of there to show their allegiance to the NFL, if you like, to the Shield, to the NFL game. And if it were one team based there permanently, would those Redskins fans or Vikings fans or Raiders fans go out to watch the Jaguars at home every weekend? That's a question that they have to consider too.
Yeah, that's all good points. Jonathan Clegg joins us, the author of The Club, How the English Premier League Became the Wildest, Richest, Most Disruptive Force in Sports. Before I get to that, I just want to ask you about the makeup from a sports appetite standpoint in England. Why does the NFL work in England versus any other parts of Europe? I know that there was a sense that there was success in Germany for NFL Europe, but really across Europe, the NFL doesn't really move the needle. What makes it different in England?
You know, that's a good question, and one that I've sort of puzzled over in the past too. I think there's a couple of things. I think, you know, the NFL established a foothold in England in the 1980s, so sort of 30 years ago now, at a time when, and this is something that we actually discuss in the book, at a time when English soccer was at a real low point. There was sort of violence and hooliganism plaguing the games. The stadiums were very dangerous and unsafe. And for one season, the game actually disappeared from TV screens because of a bust breakup in negotiations between the teams and the TV broadcasters there. English soccer wasn't shown on TV in England. So the NFL started being shown on TV there at that time and really took off because it was a complete antidote to everything that people were disappointed with English soccer. This was a sort of super loud, colorful, exciting game. It's like the sort of epitome of Americana. Felt so different to everything that they were used to seeing back home. And so I think that the fact that it established a foothold then has really helped it now, because those kids who grew up watching the NFL on Sunday nights, as it was then, in the UK, they are now the adults who are going to these games, taking their own kids along. So I think that helps. And then I think there's something about the English kind of sports culture and tradition that helps too. When you look at the UK, Britain, versus the rest of Europe, you know, very few other they play sports that sort of are related to the NFL, even though they're not exactly the same. So you have rugby, which is big in the UK. That's not really played anywhere else on the continent. And if you look at the NFL and sort of squint a little bit, you can kind of see how its origin started in rugby still. You know, the ball is the same shape. There's the sort of same sort of hitting and tackling techniques that you see. So I think that the British sports audience is sort of more accepting of the NFL, more kind of used to what they're seeing. And so the combination of those two factors meant that that Britain has sort of worked as a sort of test case for international fandom, whereas, you know, Spain, Germany, as you mentioned, the Netherlands, where they hosted an NFL Europe team, those places weren't quite so successful.
Mm. Jonathan Clegg joins us from the Wall Street Journal, author of The Club. And the book is fascinating because the English Premier League has just taken the sports world, the business world, the globe by storm over the last 25 years. And it's the one league, I think, internationally, the NFL owners aspire to. I think the NFL owners feel completely proud and confident in everything that they do, but they look at the English Premier League and say, how can we derive revenues like that? How can we do things like that? But the flip side actually was the case. How did the 20 owners of the English Premier League look at the NFL and say, we want to do that 25 years ago?
Right, which was something that I had no idea about until we started reporting this book. But it's incredible how much the NFL was a blueprint for what the Premier League did. As I mentioned, the English soccer in the 1980s was going through a very difficult time. There was, you know, fan violence. This was not a game that was in any way a sort of viable global entertainment product. But for a small group of guys, four, five, six guys, young guys who own teams and sort of had ambitions to do something more with English soccer, they looked across the Atlantic and saw what the NFL was doing. And they not only took sort of broad business ideas from the NFL, the idea, for instance, that you should sort of consider the league to be first and foremost a TV product, that getting this thing on TV in households around the country was the most important thing, and that the sort of live experience was secondary to that. So they took those sort of broad business ideas, but they also were shameless in ripping off like much smaller and sort of more granular details that they saw in these stadiums and loved. They took Monday Night Football wholesale, saw the success of that in the U.S., just ripped it off, brought it back, established a Monday night game, which had never existed in English soccer before then. The owner of Manchester United came over and watched the Jets play the Raiders and was so enamored with the Raiders and Al Davis and their cool black uniforms that he went home. And the following season, Man U started wearing black jerseys on the road. So everything about the NFL, they were consumed by it and trying to make a product that could match that. And that was the impetus for forming this breakaway league. They in 1992, the owners of the top 20 English teams broke away from the rest of English soccer. And they'd been tied, previously they'd been tied, all 92 teams had been tied together in one sort of vast league over four divisions. But the top division broke away, they set up their own league and decided to sell and market their TV rights themselves. And that really was the genesis for the Premier League success. In the following 25 years, they were able to sell their rights for bigger and bigger fees. Every sort of new cycle, the TV rights fees skyrocketed. And we get, you know, eventually we get to the stage now where the Premier League is this huge sort of global behemoth that is shown in 185 countries around the world every weekend. There are only 192 recognized by the United Nations. So almost every country on earth shows the Premier League every weekend. And as you say, that is something that the NFL owners, and there is a small group of NFL owners who also own Premier League teams. And every time the NFL owners meet for their owners' meetings, these guys form a little caucus and meet up over dinner to discuss what they can take from the way the NFL is doing business and bring it back to the UK. But those guys, the NFL owners, the one thing that they are jealous of in terms of the Premier League is its international reach.
And we've seen the incredible growth by NBC Sports Network and NBC and its family networks broadcasting English Premier League here in the States. And ratings are good and revenue is good, and that continues to grow as well. So it has certainly worked here in the States. The club, Jonathan Clegg, is the co-author of this book. And you mentioned some of these American sports owners that have gone to the English Premier League. John Henry owns the Red Sox. He owned Liverpool. Stan Kroenke owns Arsenal. Kroenke owns a billion, seemingly, teams here in the States, including the Los Angeles Rams. The Glazer family as well, who owns the Buccaneers. Out of these American business titans, who's the most unpopular across seas? Because let's face it, it's never popular for somebody from a different country to walk into the English Premier League and plop down the money and the cash.
Right, right, exactly. And, you know, the Manchester United were sort of the first team to fall to U.S. owners. They were bought by the Glazer family in the early 2000s. And that takeover was phenomenally unpopular, in part because of the way the Glazers bought the team, which was loading a bunch of debt onto Manchester United in what's known as a leveraged buyout. But, you know, that Manchester United has actually been very successful under the Glazer family and carried on winning the Premier League and the Champions League trophy. But even today, you see Love United, Hate Glazer stickers on the seats at Old Trafford Stadium. But I think the one owner who's more unpopular than anywhere else is actually an owner who has since sold up, which is Randy Lerner, the former owner of the Cleveland Browns. He bought Aston Villa Football Club in Birmingham, a century-old team which had a long history of success. And he actually went over there and tried to hide his American background in some ways. He refused to do TV or radio interviews because he knew that some of the locals might find the idea of an American accent somewhat confusing or somewhat displeasing when they heard the owner of their team talk in a way that sounded foreign. So he was sort of active about trying to hide his American background or at least trying to conceal it from the fans. But he found the Premier League to be so chaotic and the way that business was done there to be so unfamiliar with what he was used to in the world of U.S. business that after 4 or 5 years, he sort of washed his hands with the team, turned the running of it over to somebody else, and ultimately got their team relegated. You know, one of the sort of great problems that American owners have when they go over to English soccer is sort of reconciling and coming to grips with this process of relegation, whereby the worst teams in the league are demoted to the minor leagues every season and the best teams from below come up to replace them. It's a financial catastrophe to have your team relegated. It can cut the value of the team in half or even more. But that was the fate that befell Aston Villa under Randy Lerner. And, you know, we tell the story of Randy Lerner in the book. He actually spoke to us in his first kind of major interview about his experience in English soccer. And we published an excerpt from that in the journal last weekend. And the vitriol that we still hear from Aston Villa fans 3 years after he sold the team is remarkable.
The Club is the book. Hate to cut you off, Jonathan Clegg, but we're up against the break right now. The Club is the book, how the English Premier League became the wildest, richest, most disruptive force in sports. Jonathan, great job of this book. Thanks so much for joining us. When we come back here at the top of the show, can we believe that Urban Meyer is done for good? DA, CBS Sports Radio.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.